Welcome to the Sex Talk Cafe, a podcast where you'll get to learn from the experts in the field of sex, love, and relationships. The mission of the Sex Talk Cafe is to normalize the conversation on sexuality while building a bridge between the sexual and spiritual. I'm your host, Susan Morgan Taylor. I'm a holistic sex therapist, intuitive coach, and specialist in women's sexuality and feminine spirituality. I'm the founder and CEO of the Pathway to Pleasure Collective, where I help women and couples around the world restore intimacy, save their relationship, and get back to love without feeling like they have to sacrifice themselves just to keep their partner happy. Thank you so much for joining me. Welcome to the Sex Talk Cafe. Hello, everybody, and thank you so much for joining me today for the Sex Talk Cafe. I am very excited to have my guest here, Wendy Dumbroff. She is a licensed professional counselor who works with individuals, couples, and families, which I'm so interested to talk to you more about that today. And also, you do some work with in sex therapy as well. So we're going to be talking a little bit about some really fun topics around issues that couples face in sex therapy, communication, lots of good stuff when it comes to couples, intimacy, and sex. And Wendy, welcome to the Sex Talk Cafe.
Thank you so much for having me, Susan. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about you and your work?
Yeah. So I, therapy is a second career for me. I went back to graduate school in my early 40s, and I'm very old now because I've been doing this for quite a long time. I talked to someone recently who was going back to school to be a therapist, and it's really kind of a calling. So to do that, you know, when you're raising your children and all, it took a lot. But how I move forward into the specialty where I am is I had a supervisor who was trained in one of my internship jobs, who was trained in couple and family therapy through the Ackerman Institute in New York City. And she was so good and so bright. I thought, oh my goodness, if I could be 10% as good as her, that would be great. So I followed in her footsteps and I trained at the Ackerman Institute in couple and family. And I found that with couples, one of the biggest issues is sex. How could it not be? And so I, subsequent to my postgrad training in couple and family therapy, I did postgrad training in sex therapy. And so I work a lot with couples. I do a lot of couples therapy, and I do a lot of couple and sexual with their sexual issues as well.
I love it. Yeah. So we're definitely going to dive into that today. And I would love to know, though, I think this family therapy piece is so interesting. I don't find a lot of family therapists out there in the world. I think it's a very unique skill and very hard to find people that actually work with families. And I'm just curious, before we dive into all the juicy sex stuff, would you talk about family therapy and how does that work? And like, what does that entail?
Yeah, you're right. It really does require some special training. And the institute where I trained is, you know, they're just known worldwide for their family therapy, and couples therapy is a part of family therapy. It doesn't always entail the whole family being in the office.
Oh, okay.
It's broken up as needed. Every therapy is tailor-made. When I work with couples, I almost always do individual sessions with some of the couples. Again, it's tailor-made. It's not like, okay, with you, I'm going to see you once and then see you once. There may be an issue that comes up along the way that I want to talk to one about and not the other. So with family therapy, it really depends. It depends if you're working with all adults, you know, parents and adult children, parents and adolescent children, parents and younger children. If I'm meeting with parents with younger children, and again, I don't do as much family therapy, but some, I would always meet with the parents first. But as the kids get older, they're adolescents, maybe I'm going to meet with everybody together first, because they might feel a little put off if they know I've met with their parents and their parents have had this chance to tell me all the terrible things about them, right? And the most important thing is that everybody's perspective matters, from the youngest to the oldest, because everybody in a room has a different perspective. And sometimes the perspective of the most vulnerable person in the room is very important, because even though the parents may not be feeling the way the child is feeling, it's important for them to know how the child is feeling. So if, let's say a 15-year-old says, I just feel like I can never do anything right. That's how it feels for me. This is my experience. Like, no matter what I do, Mom, you're like, tell me it's wrong. Or no matter what I do, Dad, you know, you get on my case. Yeah. So it's really important for parents to know that, be able to hold that for their child.
Yeah.
And the my job is to facilitate communication between parent and child.
Okay.
It's not for me to be the primary, you know, person. I'm going to go away one day. I want to foster the relationship between parents and
Beautiful. And just to clarify, you are in New Jersey is where you have your practice and clients. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Wonderful. Okay, good. Yeah. And we'll give our listeners a way to reach you at the end of our show today. Let's dive into the couples work, because I work with a ton of couples as well myself in my practice. And I would love to hear for you just a little bit about your work with couples. For example, like, what's the main issue that couples tend to seek out therapy
yeah.
for?
Yeah. So, you know, as you know, as a couples therapist, oftentimes they come and they say, we just don't communicate. We don't communicate. So, okay, what does that mean? You know, what does that mean? Oftentimes you find they really are communicating. They're just not communicating in a useful way, you know, because shutting down and shutting down is communication. It's like, I don't want to talk to you. I don't want to talk to you, but it's not useful in their relationship. So sometimes it's communication. Sometimes it's sexual issues. The most common sexual issue that couples present with is discrepant desire. Yeah. One person wants sex more than the other. And by the way, not always, you know, people will think, oh yeah, the man always wants sex more than the woman. Not necessarily. Sometimes there's been a betrayal. Sometimes there's been some sort of betrayal, either an affair or a financial betrayal, or, you know, something of that ilk, substance use. In my practice, I often see affairs, and I've worked with many couples around.
Yeah, well, that's an area that I want to chat with you about, in addition to the desire discrepancy, because those two things are really common. And I know that, yeah, the desire discrepancy when it comes to the sex therapy piece is really one of the main challenges that couples face and why they're going to seek out help from a professional. Let's touch on that first, and then I am curious about how you deal with the affair piece. I think that's a really unique area as well, and not an easy one. I'd love for our listeners to glean some wisdom around that today. But as far as desire discrepancy goes, tell me about, how do you approach that? What do you see as sort of the root cause of that? And what's your solution when you work with couples that are facing that challenge?
Yeah, well, solution is an interesting word, right? Because I don't think there's any one fit for anybody. You know, sometimes discrepancy might be as simple as one person just has more of a desire for sex than the other. Emily Nagoski talks about in her book, she talks about, you know, some people have a heavier break and some people have a heavier accelerator, right? But I always do a relational and sexual history with people, because sometimes there's things in their past. They may have shame around sex. That's all unconscious, right? So sex just isn't, they don't want to move into sex because there's some old messages they got from their family, from the culture, from their religious background. And so they move away from sex for that reason. And they may not, and I find often don't connect their past experience with their present experience.
Yeah, and I'm very familiar with Emily Nagoski's work and the book Come As You Are. For anyone listening, it is a great read. I do find it actually a very meaty read and a little bit like information dense and a little bit, I don't know, I think it can be hard for the average person really to like make sense, like great information, but one of the things I think is difficult about that is how actually applying that in a practical way into your sex life. Wonderful information though, and I think clinically, you know, I think every sex therapist should definitely read it. Clients who are interested should read it. But I'm curious how you implement some of that, you know, the brakes and the accelerator. Well, a history of shame, for example, that's not even conscious, that can lead to brakes, Right. So the brake's an accelerator for those listening. You know, it's like the sexual nervous system has an accelerator and a brake. And some people have a really, really high brakes and so have a hard time getting aroused. Others have really low brakes, but a really fast accelerator. And I love that model. But talk to me about how you actually implement that in a practical way to help your clients.
Yeah, great question. Very much the research out of Canada, which talks about willingness.
Yeah.
And that the fact is, it seems like such a simple word, right? We may not be in the mood for sex. And if there isn't some bigger historical sexual issue where, you know, maybe there's been abuse or maybe there's been, you know, somebody's sexual boundaries were crossed or really deep shame around sex. Those are issues that need to be worked through. But the concept of willingness is, okay, I don't really feel like it, but my partner does. Can I be willing?
Yes.
And often sexual desire follows, right? It's responsive desire. And you're like, oh yeah, this is why I like to do this in the first place, right? This actually feels good.
Yeah, I love it. And I'm not sure which research you're referring to out of Canada, but in a model that I work with in my practice called the Wheel of Consent, the willingness, wanting versus willing. So that's a very important distinction. I want to have sex as a desire versus, you know, I'm not desiring it, but I'm willing to engage in it. The two different things.
Yeah.
And I think there's a danger, though, when you go into the willing. How do you help people discern that? Because what can tend to happen is the sort of the saying yes when you really mean no and you're maybe not really willing. So you're kind of doing it anyway, which I know that will shut down the sexual arousal over time and the desire for sex over time. So how do you help people distinguish that? And maybe talk about the research you mentioned, too.
Yeah, Rosemarie Basson out of Canada and Lulan, I can't recall her first name.
Okay.
You're right. It's got to be, there has to be willingness. And then I believe it's Lulan's model. So it's not at the top of my brain.
Sure.
But also talks about the fact that sex does not have to end in orgasm. It can end in pleasure. It can end in feelings of connectedness.
Yeah.
It can end just because somebody says, you know, okay, I think that's enough for me. Right. And so willingness, but never by force or never by not both parties being consensual to what is happening. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And how do you help your clients discern willingness? And they know they're willing versus just sort of tolerating something.
Well, if they're tolerating something and if they're not willing to be willing, then that's another exploration, I think. Then it's usually, a lot of times people will hear willingness and they're like, oh, you know, I never thought about it that way. Like, can I just be willing?
Yeah.
But when somebody is not willing, then there's often some deeper issues. And, you know, sometimes the couples come in and they say, yeah, no, we're not having any sex, but they're also like not connecting outside of sex, or, you know, they're either arguing or they're totally disconnected, or one person's shutting down and one person's pursuing. So, so sometimes you have to kind of work on the couple's relationship before they can even get to a place where they can be willing.
Yeah. And that's such a good distinction, because I think if you don't even have willingness, it's a different issue.
Mm-hmm.
It's an issue that does need to be addressed. And it sounds like that piece comes back around to this communication part.
Yeah, the communication. And also, you know, I don't want to also give short shrift to people who have had abuse, sexual abuse, childhood sexual abuse. There can be a lot of trauma around sex.
Yes.
And so that, you know, then it's a whole other story. They can't be willing, right? They may be willing to engage to a certain point, but it really has to be at their pace and stop at you know, any issue that's going on. I don't want anyone who's listening who may have experienced that to feel pathologized if they're not willing.
Right.
Which
we tend to do that. Like, do you find, because I kind of feel like even that conversation around high sex drive, low sex drive, my opinion on that is I think that's kind of a myth. I think we have different paths to arousal. and Brakes and Accelerators, like in the Come As You Are book by Emily Nagoski, is a wonderful model. It's not the only one, but we have different maps of arousal or erotic landscapes. If you're familiar with Jack Marin's work on the erotic mind, he talks about the erotic landscapes, and everyone's wired a little bit differently. So I am a little curious about, what are your feelings when you hear, you know, desire discrepancy being one of the main things that brings people into sex therapy and couples therapy. But how do you manage that conversation around the sex drive? She's got a high sex drive. I have a low one, or vice versa. And how do we, a lot of times we're trying to bring that low drive partner up to match the high drive partner. And I think that's a mistake. What's your take on it?
No, I agree. I think I don't ever want to make anybody do anything or have somebody feel as though they're being forced into a situation that they don't want to be in. I think whether or some other behavior, some other survival strategy or, you know, coping mechanism that people have in their life, I genuinely believe that people have good reasons for the things they do. When you do their family history and you really understand, and through my Ackerman training, I always do a genogram, which is very relational. And, there's reasons. There's reasons people learn to shut down because there was no one was going to hear them. So they just recognized they were never going to have a voice. So they don't talk. Like, oh, my husband never talks. He just goes in the other room and he won't talk to me. Okay, I'm curious. I want to find out why. I want to find out what's behind that. And then you can highlight, well, maybe that's how you had to survive in the family you grew up in, but that strategy is not useful in this adult relationship because context has changed. And I think it's the same thing with sexual issues, right? If somebody comes in with low desire, let's find out, let's talk about it. Because generally there is something more compelling underneath that. Versus just low desire.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Look, how do you use another thing in your practice, just shifting a little bit here, the use of mindfulness? Why don't you tell our listeners, like, what is mindfulness for those who don't know? And how do you use it, particularly when it comes to sex and intimacy?
Yeah. So mindfulness is, just to define it, mindfulness is being present right in this moment, right now. So for anybody listening or watching the podcast, you just sort of come into this moment now and just notice perhaps the seat underneath you, any sounds that might be around you, any particular feeling in your body that's you're noticing, right? Just being present right now, being aware. And just as you're being aware, it's also bringing a kind attention to whatever is being known. So it's having compassion, and Jack Kornfield, one of my teachers in the world of mindfulness, calls mindfulness loving awareness, because you have the awareness itself of what is happening right now, and you also have that kind, loving emotion that you bring to whatever is being known, whether it's anger, whether it's sadness, whether it's neutrality, whether it's an itch on your head, just noticing anything with a loving attention.
Yeah. And right. I love that, because I think when it comes to relationships, and especially to sexual intimacy, very often we are not bringing that type of presence or attention to what is happening when couples are struggling. We go into reactivity. I see couples go into reactivity or to shut down, not being able to kind of bridge the gap between where they're stuck and where they want to get to. And it sounds like being mindful and cultivating that skill is sort of a bridge between those two points. And I'm curious if you can talk about how you use that to help people resolve their sexual challenges.
Sure. Mindfulness and sex, right? Being aware of, okay, what's going on right now? Oh, I notice I'm pulling back. Mm-hmm. What else is happening? What are my thoughts? What are the emotions? What is it like in my body? And that is basic mindfulness. But one of my mentors, Suzanne Iacenza, who's a sex and couples therapist in New York City, she, you know, it's sort of her model to give people tasks with mindfulness, right? So if you're doing maybe just a hand massage, right, to take turns being the giver, the receiver, you know, just getting people to touch again if they haven't touched in a long time, and then to pause after, set a timer for 5 minutes, do that, and then write down thoughts, feelings, and what it was like in your body to do that for the other person. Mm-hmm. And during sex, just being aware of, oh yeah, I'm pulling back, and what's that about? And being able to, and then just coming back to the moment, right?
Because the tendency, like when you say, right, coming back to the moment, is sort of staying with the experience as it's happening, even if it's shut down or anger or confusion, versus like going up into the head or checking out or disassociating.
Yeah. Well, disassociating, it could be different, right? When somebody is sort of checking out, usually, obviously, if they've had trauma in their past, and especially sexual trauma, and that's how they coped, by disassociating from the moment. That, again, that's a whole different thing. But if someone notices, oh, he's touching my stomach, and oh my God, is he thinking my stomach's fat, right? See all the extra stuff we're adding on to the sexual experience. And then, can I just come back to that, to the pleasure? Can I come back to being present in my body?
Yeah.
Noticing, oh, it's hard for me to be present in my body, right? Mm-hmm. Those are then things you can work on, right? Yeah. Those are then, it's all stuff that comes up and comes out, like, oh no, I didn't realize part of the reason I'm pulling away is because I'm so self-conscious about my body. And when he touches my stomach, I feel so gross. And then I want to get away.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, and I agree, like the ability to strengthen that muscle of being in the body, just focused on physical sensation, can take us out of the, you know, the metacognition where we're like observing ourselves and having an experience, and back into just having the experience, which is just sensation really at the end of it. Would you agree? Like being focused just on the sensation happening instead of like the analyzing the sensation or the thoughts.
Right. Not analyzing in the moment, but I think that's useful in the therapy, right? Like, okay, and that's why Suzanne Iacenza has people write things down, because then you can bring that in. Oh, I noticed that. And so then you can work on coming back to the moment, right? Yeah. I'm not saying go into all the analysis when you're in the middle of, but noticing, okay, that's pulling my attention away. Just like when a person might sit in meditation, right? And they're focusing on the breathing.
Yeah.
Breath, pause, out breath, pause. And then all of a sudden your mind wanders. And then at some point you realize, oh, I'm not focusing on the breathing, and you come back.
Yes. Right?
And so it's, yeah. So if that's.
Yeah. And I didn't mean analyzing. Yeah. We're on the same page. You mean analyzing like while you're having sex, but not doing it back, just being present with the breath or the sensation in the body instead of being in the head analyzing what's happening.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's what I thought you meant.
Yeah. Okay. Nice. So let's talk about affairs and affair recovery. I mean, I think this is such a very challenging area, and obviously an area that you have experience and skills in. Well, tell me what you see when clients come to you with this challenge.
Yeah, well, as I'm sure you know, it's a crisis in a marriage. You know, when I work with couples in general, I use a model developed by Michelle Shankman and Mona Fishbane called the vulnerability cycle, which is a circular model really that looks at what happens between people.
Right.
And when there's an affair, there is the crisis cycle. There's what's happening now. Of course, you've got to hear all the pain. You've got to validate all the pain. You've got to, and you know, there, if the person who is in the marriage wants to maintain the marriage, you know, there's a lot of pain on both sides. Or even if they don't want to maintain the marriage, you know, both partners have pain. So you really do. I mean, it may sound counterintuitive. Why would you empathize with that betrayer person? But they're struggling as well. And it may be in different ways, but they are struggling as well.
And that's a really good point to make, because I think what happens when there has been an affair, we tend to blame the cheater, you know, the one that went outside the marriage for whatever reason. They're the bad guy. You know, the one who didn't cheat is the victim. And you can really get caught in, especially I'm sure as a therapist, caught in the middle of that. And it's not productive, but I can also see how that could sort of rub people the wrong way. Like, if people listening to this might be like, well, why would you validate the cheater? They're the one that cheated. They are the bad ones. They did the bad thing. It's their fault. They messed everything up. But really, both people have something that played into what happened. And can you talk more about that? Like, what leads to somebody stepping out? And what's the role of the person that didn't step out? Potentially, what are just some things? Like, this is not every case across the board, but a lot of times, you know, both people contributed somehow to the relationship that kind of led to where things landed. And one person made the choice to step out, agreed, but talk about sort of the co-creation that happens to
That's the perfect word. Every dynamic is co-created. It's never a good choice in a monogamous relationship to have an affair, because that is going outside the boundaries of the relationship. But, you know, there is that cycle that's going on between people. So let's say, and I will be heterosexist here and talk about a heterosexual couple where the man had an affair, right? And so let's say their dynamic in their life, there's the cycle that they were in, the co-created dynamic that they were in, is that when the woman felt unheard, she asked for something, asked him to do something, has asked him to clean up 100 million times. He doesn't clean up, as he forgot to get her, pick up her dry cleaning. He forgot, you know, he left his dirty dishes on the sink, right? And she pursues, critically pursues, right? So she's feeling unheard. She pursues critically. The more she critically pursues him, the more he feels like maybe a failure, maybe not good enough, right? He shuts down. I'm giving an amalgam of, you know, couples I've seen.
Yeah.
He shuts down, right? So he's feeling not good enough. He shuts down. The more he shuts down, the more she feels unheard, the more she pursues, right? And then he meets someone who thinks he's like the greatest thing since sliced bread, because of course all that new energy relationship, right? And and so something happens there, but then you get these people in the office like, no, I love my wife, I don't know what I was doing, I shouldn't have done that. So then you really have to look at what was going on in the relationship, and those are things when I do their family history, like, why does he shut down, why does she pursue, why is she so triggered if she feels unheard, why does he feel not good enough if he feels, you know, if she's pursuing him, right? And often that is, those triggers and survival strategies are buried in the families of origin. So making them aware. And here's another place where mindfulness comes in, right? Oh, I notice I'm about to shut down. I notice I'm going to go into my old survival strategy. But when I shut down, my wife feels unheard. So it's a model that I literally draw for people. It's a circle, right? And so being aware that you're about to shut down gives you access to perhaps staying present, to doing something.
You get choice, I think, when you're aware of the process that's happening with shutdown, be like the process, right? And then we're aware, we can make a different choice. And that's kind of the change happens.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, and you know what, so when an affair happens, you know, the biggest thing is that breach of trust and that feeling of betrayal. How do you help couples rebuild that? I think that's the most common question that people would ask after an affair. Like, how do you get the trust back?
Yeah, well, let me just say, if we could find a pill for that or some magic cure for that, we'd be really rich and we'd be, I don't know, off on an island somewhere.
Exactly.
Because that is very challenging and it takes time. And I think a lot of time what happens is the person who's done the betraying gets a little tired of being, of their partner saying, oh, I don't trust you, or where were you? What's that text you're sending?
Yeah.
So, you know, there's transparency is good. You know that, okay, yes, you can look at my phone if you need to look at my phone. You can look at my computer if you need to look at my computer. Yeah. Most people don't really want to. I find that, again, being heterosexist, if we're looking at a relationship where a man had an affair, most women say to me, I don't want to be a detective. I don't want to do that.
Right.
But I maybe want to know that I can. It's like, I don't want that to be my role. But if he wasn't hiding anything, why wouldn't he let me see it? So there's that initially. I wouldn't want that to go on forever. And I find that over time, if people choose to stay together, that it subsides, that generally people can feel good together. And there are always going to be things that get triggered. An anniversary, something happens, the anniversary of the day she found out, the anniversary of, or they drive by somewhere, she knows he went with her. So there may be things, but it's kind of like grief, right? You never fully get over the loss of the person you love. There's moments where you still miss them. And I could be wrong. Maybe there are people out there that have fully gotten over these kind of things. What I see is that there's always some tendrils that can be sort of activated on the road.
Yeah.
When things like that happen.
Yeah. And do you find, as far as the motivators, what kind of leads to it, in terms of, I'm sure you're familiar as a therapist with attachment styles.
Yeah.
That what drives people that have a more anxious attachment style to have an affair is a little bit different than those that have, say, an avoidant attachment style. And I'd be curious if you want to speak to that a little bit, because I think it's interesting. I think it's a helpful thing to know.
Yeah. You know, I don't do any assessments on attachment style, but of course I'm quite familiar with attachment style. That would actually be a great thesis, you know, a great dissertation to, you know, affairs on different attachment styles. I could see the avoidant person, you know, definitely saying like, well, you can't count on anybody for anything, so I'm just going to do what I need to do here, right? Yeah. This person isn't here for me. Oh, that's not surprising. I'm going to take care of my needs somewhere else. The anxious attachment person may be more likely to be clinging on after the fact. But I don't think I could say. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I do, because the feeling that I, and like some of the stuff that I've come across around that, which I have found very helpful. A lot of times, like when someone with an anxious attachment style often will step out because of their insecurity in the primary relationship and the fear, the feeling of not being loved, which is very common in an anxious attachment style, or the fear of abandonment. So they'll seek outside for that validation and that feeling of being wanted and loved if they're not able to find a way to get or feel it in the primary. Whereas the avoidant types, it more often is kind of like, well, what you said, I think too, like, I'll just get my needs met over here because it's not going to happen here. But also the need for freedom that avoidants tend to have. It's more of an affirmation of that when they step out. If they feel boxed in or clamped down, they'll seek an affair because it gives them that feeling of being free. And so I think that's an interesting way to distinguish certain motivators of why people sometimes step out.
Yeah, I would. I think that's very on the mark. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, would you help a couple who maybe has the doubt and the suspicion that a spouse is cheating, and maybe they're kind of hiding their phone or acting different, but they're afraid to confront the spouse because it's going to open up a can of worms and cause an argument, or the person's just going to deny it anyway? How would you coach somebody or counsel somebody around that?
Yeah, well, if I'm working with the couple, you know, the way I like to work with couples is I ask them up front that I will see you both individually at times as is needed. And the way I prefer to work is that what is private, what happens in the individual sessions is private to the extent that you tell me it's private, so that you know that I may hold a secret. And as long as they agree to that, and I would say, I don't think I've ever had anyone that didn't agree to that. Then I can ask the person, I can say, what's going on? I've still had people that haven't been honest with me, even if they have that set up, but I can ask them, and then we can talk about it. And, you know, what do you imagine, you know, and how will I be useful to you if you want to continue this, or if you're planning on not, you know, separating from this affair partner, it's a discussion to be had at that point.
Yeah, and I think that can be a really tough position to be in as a therapist. What do you do if someone does disclose, I am having an affair and I don't want to end it, I want to keep it going? How do you handle that in a couples therapy situation?
Yeah, well, I explained to them, you know, how do you imagine you will engage in this relationship when you've already got a foot out the door? And it's a whole exploration. What are you getting in that relationship? What do you think you're getting in a relationship that isn't being met in this relationship? I can sort of highlight how it, again, makes sense.
Yeah.
Might be useful, right? Okay, so you don't feel loved in your current relationship, right? You feel not good enough all the time, and this person gives you that. I also try and highlight for people the fact that affairs are like, you know, kind of going on vacation to some fantasy island, and there is, you know, it's a new relationship, so there's that infatuation that it doesn't include real life. There's no bills to be paid. There's no children to get to practice, or, you know, who are talking back. It happens in a vacuum. So it's really not reality. And at the end of the day, like, when that relationship will not stay the way it is, if you enter, you know, leave this marriage and enter into that relationship, to just be aware of that and to help people understand how much they do have in the universe. I guess as a couples therapist and as a mother, you know, I am all for working, as long as there's, you know, a healthy foundation to help couples stay together.
Yeah, beautiful. Would you be willing to share a little bit just about your own personal story? I know you said a little bit about therapy as a second career, but I am curious about what draws you specifically to intimacy, sex therapy, and working with couples. Like, do you have any personal history around that within your own life that you'd be willing to share with our guests?
Of course. I have been married to the same man for 33 years. And, you know, if I offer that, if couples want to know a little bit about where I am, you know, who I am, it doesn't mean that every one of those years was the best year, right? Just because I'm a couples therapist doesn't mean relationships don't take work. And we're, you know, it's kind of like cool now that our children are grown and, you know, out of the house, and it's just us, and there's really not that much, you know, to argue about, right? But raising kids and having a family is challenging, and we all come with our history, and then one history meets the other history, and it doesn't always go so well. So no, all of those years weren't the best years, and we have done some couples therapy together as well in the past. And, you know, when things are awry, we need to sit down and talk about it. But all in all, I'm glad that I'm still here. It's been worth it.
Yeah, that's wonderful. 33 years, congratulations. And that is really beautiful. I'm sure that really informs your work with couples. You've obviously been through a lot on your own, and you have that, you know, experiential learning that I think is really valuable to bring to the table.
Yeah. It's the only job. I think our job is the only job where the older you get, it's like, it's useful, right?
It's kind of true. Yeah. And I know you said this was a second career for you, which I think is really common in the counseling. I mean, actually for me as well, my first career was as a massage therapist, and I went and got my counseling master's degree. And there were quite a few people in my master's program who were in second career, and even much older than I was. I was in my mid-30s at the time. We had people in their 50s even. And you're right, like, it is sort of one of those wisdom professions where the more life experience you have, you do have more to draw from. It doesn't mean a younger therapist cannot be of great value. There's a lot to be said, you're right, for life experience and just the gleaning of that wisdom and living through some things.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, I'm sure you do really beautiful work with your clients, and I would love to give you an opportunity in closing our interview here today just to let our listeners know how they can contact you. How can they find out more?
Oh, okay, sure. Yep. I have a website, WendyDumbroffTherapy.com, and it's Wendy with an I. And I'm really just licensed in New Jersey, so that's really all. I can't see people outside of New Jersey.
So anyone in New Jersey can work with you. Do you do virtual or only in person?
I do both. I'm hybrid. I do both.
Awesome. Which is great. And I big shout out for virtual work to our listeners. It really is equally effective and very convenient. So that's good to know you do that. And your website is useful as well. You have some resources there. So listeners, please do check out Wendy's website. I will drop that in the show notes so that you'll have access to it there. And yeah, thank you so much for joining us today, Wendy. This has been a lot of fun chatting with you.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you for joining me today for the Sex Talk Cafe. Please be sure to show your support by subscribing to this podcast and sharing it with your friends. To keep in the loop on future events and happenings, and to grab your copy of our free ebook, The Pleasure Keys, 7 Secrets to Feminine Sexual Fulfillment, visit us online at pathwaytopleasure.com.